I'm Ann Davis. This is Desert Air, a show that tells the stories of Las Vegas's many communities, from artists and foodies to teachers and coaches. 2024 was a big year for food in the valley, both on the haute cuisine and street eat sides. But what stood out among the pack? We brought in the professionals to answer. In this episode, State of Nevada producer Mike Pravat interviews Lorraine Blanco-Moss and Brent Holmes, both local chefs and producers of their own food reviews. They dish on the tastes and trends that defined the year in dining.
Each year, our city regional magazine, Desert Companion, honors the best restaurants, chefs, and restaurateurs in Southern Nevada. This year, one thing is clear. Las Vegas does Japanese and Japanese-influenced food very, very well. But our dining coverage does not stop at places for which you might need a reservation. Thriving in spite of new regulations is a new wave of named and unnamed street vendors popping up all over Las Vegas. And if there's a through line here, it's that the demand for great food is growing quicker than the valley's population. Here to expound upon all this are two of Desert Companion's dining writers, Lorraine Blanco-Moss and Brent Holmes. Lorraine and Brent, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Lorraine, let's start with the restaurant awards. When you, as a food writer and as a chef, are asked to think about the best dining spots and menus and chefs in all of Las Vegas, what's your criteria? How do you pick nominees and winners among thousands of possibilities?
There are way too many possibilities nowadays. I'm thinking like, well, what's the best in Summerlin? What's the best in Chinatown? How do I feel about these restaurants in North Las Vegas? And so I kind of start there. I think about the meals that I've had where I can't stop thinking about them and I can't stop thinking of a certain dish. You know, as a dining writer, when you are at a restaurant and you can't wait to come back to the restaurant and try the rest of the menu.
Now, Japanese-influenced restaurants and chefs fared very well in this issue. As I mentioned earlier, they garnered several awards. Foodies in this city know that Las Vegas does Japanese food very well, especially when you go beyond the usual sushi and teppanyaki joints. Why did Japanese food have an especially good year in 2024?
I think the thing now in Vegas, which it's kind of been big in bigger cities for a long time, Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, omakases. So they become very big in Las Vegas, these sort of smaller places that have very specialized, very high-end sushi, high-end fish, high-end steaks. And that's kind of why it's flourishing.
Now, you wrote specifically about Moya. This is a Nikkei restaurant. It merges Peruvian and Japanese food. It took the prize for best world cuisine. How did Moya win you and the other judges over?
I love Peruvian cuisine. And since I can remember, I've lived here on and off for the past 22 years or so. There really hasn't been a standout Peruvian place. There've been a couple places where you can get lomo saltado and, you know, like just the meat and potatoes type thing. And there's some places that had some ceviche. There's definitely some world cuisine restaurants that sort of have all different kinds of Latin cuisines that have some great Peruvian dishes, but there really hasn't been a standout Peruvian place in as long as I can remember. So that's one thing. Two, I just love those restaurants that are off the beaten path. I mean, this is just sort of in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of nondescript and not something that you would imagine to be amazing until you walk inside. It's got great ambiance. It's dark. It's moody. The food is absolutely insane. It's one of those restaurants where I took a bite and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to try every ceviche on this menu. Nikkei is something that is very popular in Peru. It's that mashup, as you said, of Japanese and Peruvian cuisine. Because of that, it has these super bright flavors, well-balanced acidity. And I just, ugh.
This spot sits just off of Bonanza and Rancho. And I got to ask, does it mean something to you as a food writer to find a great place in a less traveled area? You know, I'm thinking maybe the equivalent of the music writer that gets excited about introducing people to an unknown indie band. Do you kind of thrive for those sort of discoveries?
Absolutely. As a food writer, we're sort of like the old-timey influencer. like the original people who would kind of introduce people to a hole in the wall. Jonathan Gold is really famous for that in Los Angeles. When he was around, that was his specialty, these mom and pop shops, these places that people didn't know about until someone told them that was an expert. And also just, you know, the chef inside me wants to bolster to help these little places where the chef, you know, worked at a fine dining place or the chef worked at all these amazing restaurants and now has, you know, done the brave thing and tried to open a restaurant on their own and nobody knows about it and it doesn't have a name and it's in kind of like a strange spot, but you're now giving them that opportunity to introduce what's special to them and what's personal to them, their story, to the rest of the Valley.
You also wrote about Gina Marinelli. This is another chef doing remarkable work here in Las Vegas. She's well known for her La Strega and Harlow restaurants, and one forthcoming, as you report. Gina was named Chef of the Year. What makes her stand out above the many other chefs?
It's really hard to pick a Chef of the Year, and there are so many local chefs now that are doing insane things. Gina has taken an area, Summerlin, that's not well known for its cuisine, and she's elevated the food. She's made Harlow a spot that is akin to the Strip. You know, you can go there and have a super fancy night out. You can go with your girlfriends or your guy friends and have a beautiful happy hour with amazing oysters and top-of-the-line steaks and caviar. These are things that weren't necessarily available in that area. Gina is really interesting to me too, because she's a female and she runs the kitchen like a strong, amazing woman. She employs many other women in her kitchen, sous chefs, as well as cooks, prep cooks. She's also just a constant student. And I think to be an amazing chef, you can't think that you know it all. And she's constantly researching. She's constantly going back and forth to Italy, trying out new dishes, coming back with interesting equipment. And this is something that not everybody does. A lot of people just kind of rest on what they're good at and stay with it. And she's always growing and she's always open to grow even more.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Lorraine Blanco-Moss about the Desert Companion Restaurant Awards, which are out in the December issue. That's available in print and at desertcompanion.com. In that same issue, our Street Eats feature looks at the expansion of sidewalk food vendors. We're also joined here by Brent Holmes, who reports that these vendors are everywhere. Maybe not in the Southwest, though, apparently.
Maybe not.
Before we get into the legal side of this industry, Brent, what explains this wide proliferation of the street food vendors?
I mean, I just to go back to what Lorraine was saying, the city really is growing in leaps and bounds. People are coming in from everywhere around the country, and they're looking for more familiar flavors. There's a broader culture of that, but I think it's just also about timing. I think after the pandemic, there's a lot of people that had life changes and shifts that want to get into a field that maybe they were daunted by. And street vending is a really affordable way to do that, right? If you can't afford a brick and mortar, if you can't set up in a strip mall and pay the rent, you can get some mobile equipment and really get going in a parking lot.
What cuisine is most represented with these vendors?
Mexican food is consistently most represented, especially if you're talking about the east side, but even more centralized. It's just easy to make tacos, and that's what you're going to see a lot of, tacos, tamales, whether it be in food trucks or in, you know, kind of these little tented structures.
Why do you think people have been patronizing or even preferring them to brick and mortar locations? I mean, why do you keep going back to them, for instance?
Well, one, the food's delicious. There's also, of course, the affordability aspect. The price point is slightly lower. They have less overhead, so they can afford to give you what you want from most of your favorite places at a reduced price. On top of that, it's availability. Who wants to sit in a drive-thru for the same old fast food burger and french fries every day of the week? I can go and get something brand new, something with a little pizzazz or at least a little authenticity right there on the street corner near McDonald's without having to put through the whole rigmarole. And it's not like fast food prices are going down.
Right. Now, you wrote that the current regulations for street vendors by the Southern Nevada Health District, whose aim is to make these culinary experiences as safe as possible, they have kind of complicated things. We've talked about them before on this show, but I guess for a quick refresher, why has this become problematic?
The state signed into law a bill that allowed for street vendors to more accessibly and inexpensively create business licenses. And then when it came down to the local level, both the county and the Southern Nevada Health District were very restrictive in their requirements, the needs for safe food handling, but also the equipment that was then became prohibitively expensive. On top of that, they have a very small department approving these requests. So they're not being seen to by rapidly as they could be. So those two things become very restrictive, both price, which was the attempt to reduce that, and in the ability to actually get all of your requests processed. It's a bureaucratic stymie, which we deal with in Southern Nevada all the time.
So, I mean, basically with all of that, a lot of these vendors have decided that it's worth the risk potentially getting in trouble because of how onerous it is to go through the proper channels.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's your dream, if that's your passion or if that's something you're good at. And if it's something that helps you pay the rent in times where paying the rent is not that easy, people are going to go for it regardless. You know, great things have been done out of desperation, especially great culinary inventions. So it's a really ubiquitous time for these kinds of services for street vending. How legal is it? How quasi-legal is it? I can't say for certain, but I'd say that a lot of them are doing it regardless of the risk.
So then what are a couple of your favorite vendors? Who do you keep going back to and why do you like them so much?
You know, I'm pretty expansive, but some of my favorite street people, I love Tacos Pasadita. They give me everything I want from a Tijuana-style Tacos El Gordo experience in a much cheaper package with a much quicker line. And they're usually a couple blocks from my house, although they have moved around a little bit. I really enjoy those guys. Almost any taco shop on the east side. Anybody's got a line more than five people deep, just get in it. And then I really, really fell in love with Moe's over by Mario's West Side Market, which are doing classic kind of stick to your ribs barbecue in a very heavily African-American community. They're sitting there in the parking lot. It is solid barbecue. And I can't say that about that much barbecue in the city in general. So going to this venue and really finding it, and you see the locals, you see the community members coming up there every time you go, and you know, get the rib tips, get the brisket. It's incredible. They've got their smoker sitting there. It's on point.
And they have beef ribs.
They do. Beef ribs are great. And like, nobody cooks beef ribs. Like, it's not always easily come by. Usually you're getting your pork ribs, your short ribs. Beef ribs are bigger, heartier, and have a very different flavor. So worth the trip just for that experience if you've never really done it.
Brent Holmes and Lorraine Blanco-Moss are dining contributors for Desert Companion, the City Regional Magazine of Nevada Public Radio. And you can read their reporting as well as the rest of our picks in our 2024 Restaurant Awards in the December issue, out now or online at KNPR.org. Brent, Lorraine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Nevada Public Radio's Mike Privat with Lorraine Blanco-Moss and Brent Holmes. Lorraine pens the Vegas Dish for Desert Companion magazine, and Brent is Desert Companion's street foodie columnist. And this has been Desert Air, the best of Desert Companion magazine in audio form. You're able to hear this without ads because of listener support. You can find more on this story and how to keep others like it coming at knpr.org. I'm your host, Ann Davis. Thanks for listening.